podcast this week, we talked to three of the 982 stars of Wes Anderson's Asteroid City. It's Adrian Brody, Jeffrey Wright, and Bryan Cranston, all at the Cannes Film Festival. How nice. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has been to the O2 in London many, many times, but has never, to our knowledge, been proposed to on stage by Hans Zimmer. How sad for us all. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. And this week, I'm in the studio once again. I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Helen O'Hara is in Glastonbury. She is headlining on Saturday night on the Pyramid Stage. But nevertheless, don't worry, don't fret. James Dyer, a great big fucking nerd, is here. Well, most of them's here anyway. Jimbo, how's the finger coming?
The finger is regenerating, much like Kurt Connors, the lizard. I'm making a full comeback, I think.
You are?
Yes. I will be able to do the fingering next time you have a flute.
Oh my word. Have you spliced your DNA with that of a lizard? What sort of lizard can grow their limbs back?
Can't they all do it?
I think it's
a pretty universal talent, isn't it? Or is it just geckos? I don't know. Find a lizard, chop off its tail, see what happens.
Yes, do that. Do that at home.
Would a T-Rex grow its own tail back? I don't know. Maybe. Let's find out.
Let's find out. Okay, we need to build a time machine, go back, obviously do the baby Hitler thing. Then we have to go back to dinosaur time.
Yes, which is the official
name. Not the Cretaceous era or the Jurassic era or any of that stuff. Dinosaur time. Then we have to find a T-Rex, no less. Chop off its tail.
And then
and see what happens.
Monitor the situation.
Yeah.
You guys have fun with that.
Yeah.
This is obviously what happened to their arms. They had massive arms and someone chopped their arms off.
And they're in the process of growing back.
Yeah, that's it. We're also joined, you just heard his voice. He is, of course, the 47th best dressed film journalist in this room right now. It is Amon Warman. How are you?
I'm good. I was a witness to Hans Zimmer's proposal that night.
That's why I set him up. You knock him down, my friend.
Which was incredible.
You and 15,000 of his closest friends.
Yeah. He was obviously putting on an amazing show. And then, he likes to talk to his audience quite a bit.
That must take ages. There's fucking loads of them.
Yeah, no, one by one. He didn't shout me out, though, for some reason. I don't know why. I mean, I thought we had like a personal connection.
You met him that one time.
You know? Look, the pictures we took, people rightfully said it looks like we're best friends catching up because that was the vibe that I got from us. But, wasn't singled out.
That's a shame.
But he was awesome in that moment.
Tell the folks what happened.
So this was just before his final encore, which was to play Time. He always ends his
Pink Floyd. Love that song.
He always ends his shows with Time from Inception. So if he played that, he brought his girlfriend on screen. He's like, this is the woman that I love. Apparently, she loves me too. Something that I wanted to ask you. Did you leave the back door open? Did you turn the stove off? Were you Miami? Could the crowd go, and lots of applause. It was great.
Oh, and where were you sitting? Were you sitting close enough for you to go, don't do it! He's mine! I have photographic proof that we vibe like BFFs. Get your hands off him!
I was sitting quite close. Right. Thankfully, the noise was so loud that it drowned out everything that I was saying.
It was so loud they couldn't hear you answering the question.
Yes, I do!
Rushing up on stage. Is there a reverend in the house? Is there someone who can marry us?
When my wedding does happen, I'll probably have Hans Zimmer playing in the background.
Interstellar.
Maybe not that particular track, but there will be some Hans at my wedding, that is for sure.
Anyway, that's exciting. That's exciting. Well done, Hans Zimmer and his lady friend, now fiance. Very, very nice. Yeah. And he went straight into the Going for Gold theme.
No, he went straight into Time right after that. And they played it together, at least the first bit of it.
So is his lady friend, now fiance, is she prodigiously gifted musically as well? Who is she? Tell us more about Mrs. Hans Zimmer.
Look, I was so hurt that I wasn't the one on stage.
You don't know who she is.
I didn't even bother to doing the research.
You are a disgrace.
It's still too soon for me, Chris. Okay?
Well, I'm going to look it up. I'm going to look it up. Hans Zimmer fiance. Dina DeLuca. She is an entrepreneur and New York hotel owner. So there you go. Hey, we're up for another award, aren't we? On Tuesday night, we are.
We're going to the...
No, Wednesday night.
Wednesday night, yes.
The PPAs.
The Periodical PPAs. Press Association, yes. Where we will periodically win awards.
But not this time.
You don't know, because Chris, last time you went, uh-huh. You and Helen went, and you lost. Because you're both, frankly, losers.
Yes.
This time... I'm coming.
You're coming.
I'm coming.
The awards magnet.
That's right. The rabbit's foot, I mean it in the Mission Impossible sense, of the Empire podcast. I will be there to bring luck and let's be honest, intimidation.
It's like Magneto. He walks into the room and all the awards are on stage. Yeah. They just begin to vibrate and then they just fly across the room.
That's exactly what's going to happen. So I'm going to go in there with my commanding presence. Mm-hmm. I shall do things like scream Dune incoherently.
What you'll do is you'll storm the stage for every single award, whether or not it's your category.
What are you up for?
Are you up for anything? I mean, I don't mean in a sexual sense.
Well, Chris.
Although Wednesday night, all bets could be off.
Oh, yes, I'm up for anything. Well, I'm up for the same thing you are. We are up for the same award. I'm not up for anything in addition to...
Oh, you're coming with me as my plus one?
Yes.
No, oh, I see.
We are going to...
How
do you not know this?
As my lackey.
I am
as
going
my Batman.
With you. We are going together. You
butler.
Are my date for the evening.
If anything, you're my fucking date.
Absolutely not. You are my date for the evening. We are going to go. We're going to win an award. It's going to be incredible. Helen's not going to be there. She will not be able to bask in our collective glory, but we will win.
Does this mean it's going to be one of like three times during here that you guys are going to get dressed up?
We haven't talked about what we're going to wear.
I'm genuinely not sure I can fit into my suits anymore. So this is going to be...
You're not fitting into mine with me.
Birthday suits.
I mean, that comes later. Look, I'm very happy to wear whatever costume you lay out for me
among
whatever materials are available.
As the 47th best dressed person in this room right now.
Yeah, what should we wear?
You can style us. It'd be like Amon Eye for Liz Slobby Guy.
Yeah.
Looking at you both, it's gonna be a challenge, but I think we can come up with something.
No, I own several pieces of a suit, which I believe I can combine.
To I'm gonna combine
this.
The Mark II and the Mark 47 and see what happens.
Exactly that. It's all nanites with me, so that's why I'm gonna turn up naked, and the suit will just sort of miraculously appear on command.
Yes, officer.
But it's a nano suit. I swear, I don't know why it's not responding. It could work. That could happen. I don't know. Is it a black tie? I'm not wearing black tie. I might concede to wearing a suit. I would rather not. So if I can get away with wearing, frankly, jeans and a Dune t-shirt,
Dune!
That's what I'll do.
Come in on those
still suits. Yeah, you said wear a suit.
Yep.
It's a suit.
What is Sir drinking? His own piss?
And like, why's your face gone red? Don't ask.
Oh, boy.
Oh, it's going to be fun. Why would you give this podcast an award?
Why wouldn't
you? You just wouldn't.
Look,
and you shouldn't, in fact.
I didn't enter, because I wanted us to win, I didn't enter the Pilot TV podcast for this award.
This is guaranteed.
I didn't want to.
You nobly stepped aside.
Exactly. I didn't want to steal the award out from under us. So I generously stepped aside. As pilot.
Of course you will be, because I believe Boyd and Kay are, even now, this is why they're not here, they're diligently digging under the stage of the PPI Awards. It's going to be like the bad guys.
You'll just see the thing and it'll be an award and it'll say Empire and it'll just be scribbled out in Sharpie and Pilot TV Podcast written underneath it.
Right.
That's how we win.
We have a question.
Do we though?
We do. It's a question we've been tackling for the last 3 weeks, which is basically which director won the 80s, the 90s, the noughties, and now the 10s,
yes.
The 2010s, not the 1910s. We're not that old. We're on the 10s now. We're on the 10s. And we said we would do this, and then we would knock this on the head. We can't just dominate the question section with this question. Although some people have been asking recently, can you do this again, but with actors? Where does it end? Writers, composers, key grips. Mm.
Ooh, composers.
Oh, God, here he goes. He's fast asleep in the corner.
Yeah.
Among some composers. Did someone say composers?
Of having a one-track mind, but I reject that. You're a man of multitudes.
He has a four-track mind, if anything. Sometimes eight-track.
Yeah.
On occasion.
What's your favorite track? Three, I agree. Right.
Five, Taylor Swift.
Barbarian Horde from Gladiator.
Barbarian Aww. Sound Studio.
Well, That's nice. Featuring Russell Crowe on vocals.
Is that your favourite from that particular...
That's my favorite track
fucking
of all
hell.
Time.
I should pull back the curtain here. I have a very, very, very heavy time constraint. And I came in here going, right, okay, 20 minutes for the listener question, 20 minutes for news, 20 minutes for reviews. We'll be fine. I think we're an hour and a half into this now. Yeah. And anyway, go on, fucking have at it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to win anything.
Barbarian Horde is my favorite track of all time.
Unleash Hell.
How does that go?
Not the track which soundtracks that is called The Battle.
Oh, sorry. Rookie soundtrack error. Okay. So the Barbarian Horde comes when?
This is the scene that precedes Maximus removing his mask and telling Commodus who he is.
That's a good
and
scene.
And also encompasses that's in the final sort of 90 seconds of Barbarian Horde are the aftermath of that, which is why it's my favorite track of all time, because that is the first track that made me realize the power of film
the
music.
The power of music. How does it go? Does it go?
That's exactly how it goes, yes. You're just going to keep going, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to know what my favorite track of all time is?
Yes, I do.
Oh,
John Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Theme from Home Alone.
Theme from Home Alone. No, it is Ben's Death and TIE Fighter Attack.
Okay.
Is my favorite.
From the first Star Wars.
From the first Star Wars. Specifically, it's the bit that transitions into the TIE Fighter attack. Mm. That's my favorite bit. The boom, 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 boom. And then it goes and it builds up. That I think that's fantastic. And when they turned Space Mountain into Hyperspace Mountain at Disney, they retrofitted it so that you're in an X-Wing fighting TIE Fighters. And that plays all the way through it. And I was like, yes! All the way around the roller coaster. I fucking love it. It's such a wonderful piece of music. And that same thing with me. Like, that was the first bit. I mean, Star Wars is full of great music, but that particular bit when I was a kid, I was like, the music elevates that scene to a level that I didn't think was possible because I was four and all 4 year olds are fucking stupid. But yeah, incredible stuff.
Yeah.
Incredible scenes.
John Williams, the goat. Yeah.
Who knew?
Amazing. He can compose all the music despite being a goat. It's just extraordinary. All right. Okay. Which director won the Tens?
I can dispense of this question very, very quickly to save you time.
Is it James Cameron?
No.
Is it Quentin Tarantino?
But it is James Cameron. But it's not. No, actually, it's not. It is Monsieur Denis Villeneuve.
Oh, my
and
God.
No, but seriously, and I can't obviously include Dune as part of this, so this is not a Dune thing. This is specifically for me, Encendi, sure, but for me, the run of Prisoners, Enemy, but specifically Sicario, Arrival, and Blade Runner. I was like, yes. Yes, mate. Or oui, monsieur, whichever you prefer.
I'm on. The rules are very, very simple. Mm-hmm. Has to be a director who's made at least two movies in the decade. Ideally, one in the first half of the decade, one in the second half of the decade. So you can't just come in, Johnny Come Lately, and make a great film in 2019, for example, and then just own the decade, right?
Gotcha. You
can't do that.
Okay.
So you have to have like a fairly varied and consistent body of work.
Okay.
All right.
My pick for this question is Ryan Coogler. Fruitvale Station,
yep.
Creed, Black yep. Panther is an incredible run of films.
That is an incredible
and
run of films.
The last two in particular, the way in which they impacted the culture, Black Panther especially, really stands out to me. That would be my pick. Backup pick would probably be Damien Chazelle, Whiplash, La La Land, Whiplash especially.
Yes.
The ending of that film is spectacular, and obviously La La Land. I love that film too.
Helen in particular would be on board with that.
Oh yeah,
she'd love
that. Huge fan.
loves it.
I've been listening to Another Day of Sun a lot recently because of the weather, and it's still a banger. So yeah.
Did you dance on top of a car roof while listening to it?
I have not done that yet, but give me some time.
Okay.
It's a total banger.
Both those good shouts. Neither yep. a patch on Denis Villeneuve, but I'll put a reserve out of my back pocket here and say, obviously, we talked about him a little bit for the noughties, but Christopher Nolan comes into his own, obviously,
in
the tens. Steady. Inception. Boom!
Inception.
The Dark Knight Rises. Bang!
Is Inception...
2010.
Yeah.
Is it 2010?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. So it counts. Inception, Dark Knight Rises, Interstellar, and Dunkirk. So,
Dunkirk is
fine.
Very good film.
It's
in fact,
fine.
I think it might be one of the four best films that you mentioned there.
that's a pretty good run.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good run.
Pretty good.
I do love Inception.
Inception.
Dark Knight Rises is my least favorite of the trilogy. I'm not a big Interstellar and Dunkirk guy. Either.
Oh, but you must love your pal, your good pal, Hans.
I love
Booby.
Uh, D- Dunkirk is not my favorite Zimmer score, although I do think Supermarine is a fantastic track. Interstellar, the use of the organ is fantastic.
He did that. I beg your pardon? Steady on.
Sometimes I just for a split second forget what podcast I'm on. It's like, yeah. And then you remind me. Thank you. Interstellar.
It's the Empire podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. I got that now. It's in my head. The instrumentation in Interstellar. is
but it's, a bit, it's clear because it's distinct from Dunkirk. Interstellar.
Oh, yeah.
Dunkirk. So, is it, like I say, it's nuanced. It's nuanced.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
These are all good. These are all good.
Yeah. But the score for Inception is freaking fantastic.
Yes, it is.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, this is interesting because none of the usual suspects have been named so far. Kaiser Schorze.
Kaiser
Schorze. Because, you know, we've done this for the last 3 weeks because we run out of ideas, quite frankly. And a lot of the same names will be cropping up in the 80s and the 90s and the noughties. Mm-hmm. And now that's beginning to change. We talked about Chris Nolan last week. And yes, you can talk about Scorsese. You can talk about, that's a really weird way to pronounce his name, by the way. I don't think anyone's ever pronounced his name that way. Martin Scorsese.
Scorsese.
Scorsese. You know, Steven Soderbergh is still a big player. Steven Spielberg, I believe, made some films of note in the 10s. Quentin Tarantino obviously made some films in the 10s as well. But things are beginning to change. The 10s is really when the Marvel Cinematic Universe really started to come to the fore. Mm-hmm. So you could, I'm not saying you should, but I'm saying if you could throw in Joe and Anthony Russo as directors who made four of the greatest blockbusters of all time, in a fucking row.
It's hard to disagree.
Yeah.
It is hard to disagree.
I didn't expect to. I don't know what to do with myself now. That's most unusual. Ryan Johnson, there's another one.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a good shout. That is a good shout.
Also, Bong Joon-ho.
Where? Oh, sorry. He's always sneaking up at me.
Snowpiercer, Parasite,
yes.
Okja.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, Greta Gerwig.
Greta
Gerwig, Lady Bird, Little Women, in which Florence Pugh dies in a hail of bullets, 2019.
Really? Yeah. You've done your research.
Yeah. Well, because it was, I always remember because it was, it came out with, as we remember, with Rise of Skywalker, because famously story about when it is Florence Pugh, I refuse to believe otherwise, dies in a hail of bullets. You heard Babu Freak going, hey, in the next theater, famously on Twitter. So that's how I tie those two films together forever, for all time.
That's nice.
The natural successor.
What about Jordan Peele?
We'll get out and.
Look, it was just a suggestion.
All right, into that one. And what was the
second one? You made two films, technically. Us.
There you go. Yeah, that'll be a good shot. I mean, Get Out was incredible. Probably still the best horror film that I've watched. One of the few horror films I've
you're
played.
Such a brainy cat. It's so amazing.
I mean, the fact that there's...
You're missing some of the greatest movie scores of all time are in horror films.
This is the thing, you don't ever watch horror films.
I don't ever is not true, but...
You know, if you listen to the scores without watching the film, it's not scary.
Yes, I know, but like I don't like doing that typically. Like I honestly try to stay away from that because part of the reason that I love film scores is my connection to the films, and I don't like to listen to scores before I watch the film.
No.
If I heard Portals before I watched Portals, it wouldn't
It doesn't have
hit
the emotional heft. Exactly. 100%. I get you. But this is interesting because I don't know how I didn't know this about you, but I didn't know this about you. Oh. Is it just because you don't like being, like you're a big scaredy cat is what I'm saying?
Yes.
That's it?
Yeah. I didn't really grow up watching horror. Like, the world is scary.
I mean, how do you think me and Chris turned out the way we did? We 100% did do that. And it fucked us up for life. So like, in terms of like horrors, like, so Alien?
Yeah. No, okay. I've gone back and watched a couple, like Alien,
I think, like, you do Alien, you do The Shining, you do The Omen.
I haven't done The Shining.
The Omen? The Omen. No one's ever pronounced that way.
Martin Scorsese says he's The Omen.
Yeah. The Omen, 555. You know, I mean, Jaws, obviously, horror.
I've gone back and watched Jaws.
Yeah. I mean, good. That's good. The Exorcist?
No.
Okay.
The Omen's.
That's where we're drawing the line.
Oscar, one of the few horror movie scores. No one's pronounced the word horror like that either.
Horror.
What's going on in horror?
It's a horror show.
people have often said about this podcast. Yeah. It is a horror show.
You'll notice the theme that it's when Helen isn't here that this podcast degenerates into absolute carnage.
Yes. Venom, let there be carnage.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, Venom. Yes. It's one of the few horror movie scores to win an Oscar. And it's amazing. Ave Satani by Jerry Goldsmith. It's so fucking good. It's so scary. And he did the score as well for Damien Omen 2. And that score in particular, I have on my phone. And I regard it as some sort of cursed object. Whenever it comes on, if I'm walking along just shuffling soundtracks, and that comes on, I go, nope, skip. Can't do it. No, thank you.
See, that in and of itself is interesting, because my favorite type of scores are the ones which work well in the film, but also I can listen back to and have fun with. I don't find that's the case with most horror scores. Michael Abels with Jordan Peele is an exception. There's a couple of, like, my favorite track of last year was Nope by Michael Abels, which was spectacular. It's a fantastic score. And I love his score for Get Out as well, and Us. Really, really good scores. But in typically with horror films, the scores work perfectly for scares in the film. But they're not very tuneful.
Sometimes they used to accentuate jump scares. Sometimes they're about building atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So yep. Horner's Alien score, though Aliens isn't a pure horror film, but look at Goldsmith's Alien score, and that is just dripping with dread and
dripping
atmosphere.
Dripping with dread.
And
dripping.
It works in isolation, 100%. That is a great piece.
It is. It is. Other great horror film scores, I mean, if you want to look up
Carpenter.
John Carpenter, obviously. Yeah. Take your pick, take your hammer and chisel, whatever you want to do. Goblin are great. And there's the score for George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead is really atypical as well. It's got some absolutely banging numbers in there. A lot of library music. Yeah.
This is good stuff, though, because it's good stuff. I've been trying to...
broaden your horizons.
Broaden my horizons.
Your event horizons.
Your event horizons.
Do you listen? But you haven't. That's the problem. You haven't seen.
I have not.
And where you're going, you do need eyes to see, because otherwise you'll only be hearing the film.
And but ears to hear.
I'm doing a daily sort of Twitter thread, one film, TV or game track a day, and I'm looking for new stuff to add to it as we continue.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm going to go investigate some of these suggestions.
We have suggested some. We have broadened Amon's horizons.
We should playlist like a horror calendar for Amon. Not to traumatise him. I mean, I think this is important. Like, because I do, I mean, as someone who, I'm quite sensitive to some horror stuff. I don't do well with nasty horror. Scary. Yes, chills. Yes, I don't do well with nasty horror.
This is why Hereditary is just
I don't think we want to give you stuff that would upset you, because I don't believe in that. But I reckon there's a good sort of menu of stuff that might ease you into the genre and make you sort of more comfortable with it without scarring you for life.
That would be nice.
All right. Okay.
All right, let's do it.
Couple more names real quick, because we are still technically in the questions section of the show because, again, the landscape changed quite a lot. I'm going to throw in Gareth Evans. Gareth Evans is someone who I think owned quite a bit of the tens, mainly because of The Raid and The Raid 2, two of the greatest action movies of all time. If you're speaking of greatest action movies of all time, then that brings Christopher McQuarrie into the conversation as well.
It does.
For he made Rogue Nation and Fallout and Jack Reacher in the same decade.
That's impressive.
Also, which is pretty damned impressive. And it also brings into conversation the one, the only, Dr. George Miller, who made two films in the tens. One was Happy Feet 2, and frankly, an abomination of a movie. The other one is Mad Max Fury Road.
I mean, you can see what he was doing thematically.
Of a demented genius, yes. So I think it's going to be one of those people that we mentioned.
We should probably throw in Barry Jenkins as well.
Yes.
Did win the Oscar for Moonlight after fashion. And,
and technically, yes, he did. Yeah.
And If Bill Street Could Talk as well, that's fantastic.
Well, listen, that is a fine parade of names with a couple of occasional diversions to actually answer the question there, which I appreciate.
Which I answered with the first answer, so that was good.
You did not.
It is 100% Denis Villeneuve. 100% Denis Villeneuve, and you know it's true.
No.
You know it's true.
I don't know it's true.
Was the film of 2015. Arrival was the film of 2016. Blade Runner was the film of 2049.
No. It was our film, yes.
No, but as in, those were our official Empire films of the year, 3 years running. Denis. That's right.
Yeah. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast, you can get in touch with us. Now questions are open again. We're opening our doors to questions. I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to a panicked shout out every now and again, or you can just reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course. Movie news. What's been happening in the world of movie news?
Chris, can I just check one thing with you? What year is it?
What year? Who's the president? let me just check. Hey, Siri. What year is it?
Uh-huh.
What year is it?
One moment.
Oh, for God's sake.
One moment, Chris. I'm going to check on the year.
Don't just bring it up on screen. Just tell... Oh, for fuck's sake. It's 2023.
Do you think the makers of Kraven the Hunter realize that?
Oh, I see. This was a bit. This was a bit all along.
Very clever setup.
I see what you did there. So you're doing a whole... Hi. The 90s called. They want their movie back.
It's so dated.
JC Jandor is making a late play to own the noughties by releasing a film in 2023.
But isn't this kind of in keeping with the whole spunk, you know, process? Like, they do seem to be specializing in throwback 90s comic book movies. That's what they do. You know, this. I mean, we've not quite gone long Morbius here, but we're not a fucking million miles away. I'd rather watch this than Morbius.
This looks like the same film as Morbius.
A little bit. But
I must say, I didn't mind Morbius.
I know. Controversial opinions ahoy.
I know. When I say I didn't mind it, I still like it's a high two, but...
Is it?
Yeah, but it's not a one. It's not a one. A two. You're a one.
This looks more entertaining than Morbius.
Does it? Sorry. Should we explain what it is for the people at home who are still somehow listening to this?
It's a Spider-Man villain reinvented as an anti-hero. It's got spunk everywhere.
Yeah.
Why are we still doing villains aren't born, they're made in 2023? Like, come here, at least come up with a better line than that. Come on.
So this is Kraven the Hunter. So if anyone knows their Spider-Man lore, Kraven the Hunter is one of the great Spider-Man villains, one of the anchors of one of the greatest Spider-Man arcs, Kraven's Last Hunt. Mm-hmm. And he is a big game hunter. If I'm right in thinking of him, he's not enhanced in any way. I don't think he has superpowers in the comics, but in the film he is.
Because a lion bleeds on him, which apparently is how he gets his superpowers.
Yeah. Do not try this at home, folks. Absolutely not. So Aaron Taylor-Johnson, okay.
In different versions of Spider-Man media,
he is... because like in an infinite multiverse, anything is possible.
Indeed. The Kraven that I grew up with was the Kraven in the 90s animated Spider-Man show. And in that, he was a big game hunter and he was fierce, but then he comes up against Spider-Man, gets his ass whooped, and he then enhances himself so that he can be on Spider-Man's level.
Do you want to know the first time I encountered that character? It was in an issue of What The, where Spider-Ham goes up against Raven the Hunter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, absolutely true.
And he has this wonderful costume. He's kind of this weird rough thing going on. He looks very, very cool. And he basically comes to town with a few days to kill, like the Predator in Predator 2. And he decides to try and go up against the biggest game he can find, which is a teenager from Queens, as it turns out. So he has a pop of trying to kill Spider-Man, and he's a big, big Spidey villain that they never quite got around to in the good films. And but here I'm a little sad about this trailer, I'll be honest with you.
Why?
Because he's played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who I like, and apparently whose performance in this movie may have actually put him and Bullet Train may have put him to the front or front-ish of the queue for Bond. Mm. And, you know, you can see he's bringing it in this. He's bringing it physically, for sure. And it's also directed by JC Jandor, who is a director JC adore, because he directed Margin Call. He directed All Is Lost. He directed Triple Frontier. He directed, you know, he's a really, really good, solid director who is clearly, you know, this is very much a one for them situation, I'm guessing. But I would have thought that he might have brought something of himself to this, but I find no Chasey Jandor in the DNA of this trailer, which is frankly pretty lamentable. And yes, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who isn't Russian in this movie, again for reasons, has daddy issues in the shape of Russell Crowe as the Pope's exorcist, reprising his role. Russell Crowe is like he's like a giant storm formation slowly moving his way across southern Europe. he's ticked off Greece. He's ticked off Italy. Watch out, Spain. Here comes Russell Crowe. Oh, no.
I have to say, he did do a magnificent tweet earlier today. There's a tweet which basically says, Russell Crowe, father of Superman, Hercules, and Craven the Hunter. So Russell Crowe quote tweets this and says, fertile across time and space. Fantastic. Fantastic.
If you need Spunk, Russell Crowe is the man to ask.
Across time and space.
He has finally come to the Spunk universe, which is no longer called that, sadly.
Sony Pictures universe of
Marvel characters. And now it's just called Shrug.
Shrug.
Just whatever, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel someone needs to stage an intervention.
But you say that. You say that. But it's a very niche.
So niche that you and I are the only people alive who will understand it. But yes.
But you say that, and yet this is still the same team that is kind of, they're there whenever the Spider-Verse movies are made. They're in the room. They're in the building.
They're in the same postcode.
They're in the same, you know.
They're staying at the same hotel.
I know that there are probably be different creative driving forces on those movies, you know, but there are people...
Whoever convinced these people that these films would work without Spider-Man, despite multiple allusions to Spider-Man in all of these films, was wrong.
Anyway, Kraven the Hunter looks good, doesn't it?
Other trailers. Yeah. There have been other trailers. There have been many other trailers, actually. Who wants to start with what? Go on, Amon. There was one you liked. Tell us about the one you liked.
There is a trailer for Challengers, Luca Guadagnino's new film starring Zendaya, who is in the middle of a love triangle with... With...
Josh O'Connor.
Yeah.
And Mike Faced.
Of West Side Story fame.
They want to take his face off.
I thought this looks really, really good. Zendaya is just an actor that I will always be interested in seeing on screen. She's so dynamic. And the chemistry between all three of them looks very interesting. Looks pretty sexy.
My word. What's it about?
It's the sequel to Wimbledon, as discussed.
So Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, who is a former tennis prodigy turned coach and a force of nature who makes no apologies for a game on and off the court.
You've just read that out.
No, I just came up with it at the top of my head. She is married to a champion on a losing streak, that's Mike Faced, and her strategy is for her husband's redemption. Okay, I'm reading this out.
No shit.
Tashi's strategies for her husband's redemption takes a surprising turn when he must face off against the washed-up Patrick, that's Josh O'Connor, his former best friend, and Tashi's former boyfriend.
What?
But obviously in a slightly more complicated, thruply, threesome-y kind of three love, if you will, and if that's how tennis was scored, which it isn't, even I know that.
This should be called Call Me By Your Game,
It should. It should.
Am I right?
15 love would make no sense because that's, you know, slightly more complicated relationship.
Oh my word.
But yeah. It looks good. And I thought the trailer was very well put together.
Advantage, Zendaya.
Advantage, Luca Guadagnino.
I've run out of all tennis terminology that I know.
Have you ever been to actual Wimbledon?
Yes.
Fuck no. I can get strawberries at my local Tesco.
I went a couple of years ago. I took advantage of I took advantage of the pandemic, but that makes me sound like a terrible, terrible human being.
Yeah, but you are a terrible human being.
I am a terrible human being.
So that's fine.
But because of all the poshos, they changed the way that they sold tickets. So usually all the poshos get them because they're super expensive. But this time they opened them to dickheads like me. So I managed to get a centre court seat.
Nice.
And I went along and I watched old Rog. I watched Roger Federer. I watched Coco Gauff. I watched someone else. So, and it was a fantastic day. I had a really great time.
Awesome.
Am I wearing a Wimbledon cap right now?
You are.
You are.
There we go. Yeah. Is that why you asked?
Was it?
I bought this at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Because I was going to go, your powers of observation are legendary, Amon.
I thought you were just a huge fan of the Richard Longcrane film. That was my just assumption.
I mean, who isn't?
Yeah.
2004, Richard Longcrane won the noddies just by making Wimbledon.
Do you know, the only live sporting event I have ever paid for a ticket for, ever bought a ticket for.
Remember, dogging is not technically a live sporting event.
It's competitive, Chris, and I'll stand by that.
Because you finish first doesn't mean...
I genuinely, I bought tickets to the UK Rampage
Again, dogging does not count.
In which the Ultimate Warrior faced off against the Undertaker in their first bout against
again,
each other.
Again, yeah. Dogging does not count. You can't just make up stuff. Ultimate Warrior,
yeah.
Undertaker.
Yeah, the very first UK Rampage.
Wow.
In the front row, as it happens.
Wow. That's amazing.
Absolutely true. Yeah.
Can you tell there's no movie news this week? I thought this trailer looked okay. I thought it looked fine. It looks all right.
It looked challenging.
I'm not so sure it did. It looks a bit glossy. But then again, so did Call Me By Your Name, I guess. Call Me By Your Name. No one's pronounced it that way.
Call Me.
Call Me. But yeah, I don't know. Is that your favorite track? Me singing Call Me By Your Name?
No,
it's not.
There is a couple of other things. Amon just pointed out off mic that we might want to talk about the box office, the state of the box office in the States, with The Flash and Elemental both, I guess, essentially flopping last weekend. Although I would quite like to flop to a $30 million opening weekend. If anyone wanted to do that for me, I'd be quite happy with that. Or a $60 million opening weekend, I'd be like, yes, please. Thank you very much indeed. But apparently it's different for a movie. Anyway, a movie that's almost certainly not going to open to $60 million, but may indeed be garlanded with awards. My God, my segue game is on point today. Is Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, which is not the Queen of the Desert, but indeed the Queen of Rock and Roll, I guess, if you could call her that, because Priscilla Presley was married to Elvis Presley. What a coincidence, they had the same surname. And last year, of course, we had Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, and I very much enjoyed it, even though it was batshit insane and bore very little resemblance to the actual story. But it was all good, and Austin Butler was tremendous, and now we have basically the same story, but obviously from Priscilla Presley's point of view. And Priscilla Presley in this movie will be played by Kaylee Spaney. And Elvis in this is played by, I really, really hope that we've written it in this new story, Jacob Elordi from Euphoria. So Jacob Elordi. So the trailer looked very, very good. And obviously there was a fair amount of controversy about Priscilla and Elvis's relationship because of her age whenever they first met. And I imagine this film isn't going to shy away from it in the way that the Baz Luhrmann film come here. Look over there! Yeah. Happy! Yeah. And then they were happily married. Yeah. And nothing bad ever happened again, apart from all the terrible things.
That's part of the reason why I'm interested to see it, because even though I had a decent time with Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, they really didn't focus on Priscilla much, if at all. And so, yeah, it'd be good to see what I'm guessing the story will dovetail with certain events that Elvis may have depicted, but from a different perspective. And that could be interesting.
Let's talk about the box office, shall we?
Box office.
So The Flash didn't, and then Elemental posted Pixar's worst ever box office receipts, and people are going, the sky is falling.
I'd say it's not so much sky as it is Disney Plus, but sure.
Yeah, it feels, well, okay, let's take Elemental first of all.
Yeah.
And then we'll move on to The Flash.
Sure.
You know, because some people are wondering if this is symptomatic of a larger malaise at the box office. I don't know. I suspect that Mission's going to do really, really well when it opens in a couple
of
weeks.
Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm.
Transformers has just done really well.
Tailed off pretty heavily.
Didn't do so. Well. Wasn't it tracking for something like 450?
It's, yeah. So a lot of these films, I wonder if the paradigm is shifting, right? So as was pointed out this week, Fast X is already out on digital.
Last weekend.
I really hate that.
Whenever Transformers Rise of the Beasts and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse came out, very, very quickly they announced when they're going to be out in digital, which is in the middle of fucking July, which is just insane.
Uh-huh.
These really, really short windows, which are, I think, re-educating people about how to see films.
Mm.
And they're basically learning, you know what? We don't need to go to the cinema unless it's really...
That's exactly what's happening. And I think it's more acute for kids' films, like Pixar films, like Elemental, because people are like... Because think about this. First of all, you're probably taking more people to go and see it, so it's going to be much more expensive with kids. And also, kids are fucking stupid. They don't care if they see it on the cinema screen or the living room. I mean, they're not that picky. And I feel like if you're reasonably confident, as you can be, that Elemental will be on Disney Plus in like 4 weeks' time, why wouldn't you wait and see it for free? And I just think it's a bad thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think for stuff like Fast X, I was shocked when Fast X dropped on sort of streaming.
Mm-hmm.
Really was. I was like, it genuinely felt like it just got released. Mm-hmm. And I just think you are conditioning audiences at this point that the windows are now so short. You are taking away, you're essentially cutting cinema's legs out from under them. You are taking away that need to go and experience this thing. And I think unless you are making a film like Dune or Mission, which, or, you know, Top Gun Maverick, whatever, you take your pick, that has to be seen on the big screen. I think increasingly you are educating people, you're teaching them that they don't need to go to the cinema. And that feels like suicide. It does.
I was going to say more people should have learned more lessons from what they did with Top Gun Maverick, which was to give it an extended sort of, you know,
Avatar
run
2
in cinemas.
Mm-hmm. Avatar 2 didn't come out on Disney Plus for at least 6 months.
Yeah, and also bear in mind, we say that, oh, like a whole 6 months. It was only 6 months. That's still not a long window. You go back to the 90s and you're talking massive windows between theatrical and home ends.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So even 6 months feels short.
With Elemental, I really liked the film, but I did come out of it thinking, I liked it. I'm not sure if kids are going to really vibe with that. Could that be a factor in the box office, you think?
Little Drinking Game actually really enjoyed it. You know, she actually appreciated the love story and was caught up in it. But I do wonder about it. The thing about it is, it looks, and when you read out the synopsis of it, it feels like it's almost self-parodic at this point. It feels like it's almost a Pixar parody. Then you see the film and it's actually got a lot more nuance and a lot more going on. It's a beautiful looking movie. But it did feel inessential. But I just think it's been a tremendous own goal from Disney, devaluing the Pixar brand essentially by putting all these great movies, Soul, Luca, Turning Red, putting them on to Disney Plus, educating people that, don't worry folks, it's going to be along any second now on Disney Plus. And then, you know, Lightyear didn't do well last year, wasn't a great film, but probably in any normal year would have done way more money at the box office. And now this. So is it any wonder then we have a preponderance of sequels and prequels and spin-offs coming our way? Like there is, I think, one original film scheduled next year. But after that, there's an Inside Out sequel. There, you know, Pete Docter was saying this week that nothing is off the table. There's a Toy Story 5, as we know. Ugh. There's all kinds of things that are up in the air. But he also made a very, very good point, which was that, yes, there's a rush to sequelize, there's a rush to prequelize, there's a rush to do spin-offs, but you're spinning off sequelizing and prequelizing things that were once original. So you should invest in the original stuff. But then the worry is that now something like Elemental will fall through the cracks. Mm. It's really, really sad. And it has a potential existential knock-on effect as well. You know, cinema chains beginning to close. We know that there's bankruptcy threats looming large. And it feels like there's a major paradigm shift coming in terms of entertainment. Like, you know, cinema chains cannot live on Avatar and Top Gun Maverick, and, you know, the MCU isn't the $1 billion guarantee it once was either.
No.
And so, interesting, potentially dark times ahead. The Flash's quote unquote failure at the box office, because, you know, certainly a movie like that, they'll be looking for it to make $500 million minimum, and it's not going to get anywhere close to that. Now you could chalk it up to a number of reasons. We said in last week's review, as we were reviewing it, some people will want to steer clear of this movie because of how they feel about Ezra Miller. Mm-hmm. I feel like that certainly did happen. A lot of people probably did give it a swerve because of that, but I think there were other factors.
Yeah,
going
it feels
as well.
Inessential because it's the sort of like coda to a thing that no longer exists, and it will not really go anywhere, and it doesn't feel like you need to see it. So, I can understand. And people have been burned by the DCEU before. There are a lot of reasons why people might not watch it, even though critics liked it.
Mm-hmm. Amon, what's your take on it all?
I definitely think the Ezra Miller factor played a role here. Not just because of the complications they are going through and how that would have sort of affect the average viewer wanting to check it out, but the lack of them being in front of cameras promoting the film. There's a reason why studios sink all that money into that. You got the person on the poster, they're not really out there doing anything. They're not on people's YouTube feeds. There's a certain sense of, like, on the one hand, I'm sad for people like Sasha Cali, who's making their debut as Supergirl. I think she's really good in the role, even though she doesn't have much to do, but there are a lot of people who have worked on The Flash who deserve to have their work seen. I had a decent time with the movie. But when you think about what's going on at Warner Brothers and the decisions that they have made to lead to this moment, I am not, I haven't forgotten about the way they treated Batgirl. Not only did they cancel Batgirl, but it felt like
they deleted Batgirl. They erased Batgirl from existence.
It's not that. And also, it felt like they took every opportunity to crap all over it. Mm-hmm. They insulted the filmmakers. They disrespected the talent at every turn. How many times did they hear this film, you know, is so bad it would damage the brand? There's a certain sense, I mean, call it karma, call it poetic justice to a degree, but I have been thinking about that a lot, given all the Flash box office numbers I've been seeing. When I read that the money that the Flash could stand to lose might be more money than what was saved by erasing Batgirl, it just makes me think about all the stuff that was said to have led to this moment.
One interesting thing that was announced last week, it was interesting that this was announced, I think, before The Flash opened, which is Andy Muschietti, who is the director of The Flash. It has been announced as the director of Batman, Brave and the Bold, which is one of the new DCU films that James Gunn and Peter Safran will be spearheading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just directed a film with at least two Batmen in it. And clearly James Gunn and Peter Safran think he's going to be in safe hands. The Bat. Or a version of the Bat. So I think that's interesting. So that, you know, I don't see that being rescinded somehow. I think that's gonna stick.
Yeah.
So maybe they knew it wasn't gonna do well. Who knows?
I will say, you know, as you know, I have very strict standards for how Batman should act on screen. And
kill them all.
Kill everyone.
The opposite of that.
Do
and
your
I
jobs.
I am pleased to say that...
Bring me people to kill. That's... Do your fucking jobs.
I am pleased to say that The Flash passes a Mon Woman's Batman test. So, congratulations to Andy. Thank you. What?
Does it?
Yes.
Are you counting Kryptonians as people?
It's aliens, it's the end of the world.
Oh, you're such a racist.
Look, I've checked the Batman bylaws and...
It's okay to kill aliens. Wow, Batman officially cancelled.
I mean, he doesn't actually kill any aliens in the...
Are you sure that when they're escaping from that big silo in Russia...
Uh-huh.
Because... No, spoiler alert, I mean... Clearly, four people watched it last week. So the four people who've seen The Flash can listen to this. Everyone else stopped listening to it.
Yeah.
When they're escaping from that silo with Supergirl, like, she kills a fuckload of people.
Yeah, Supergirl kills people.
But you don't have a problem with that, do you, Mr. Hypocrisy, Mr. Double Standards?
Look, I'm talking about Batman here, one.
Oh, okay.
Two, this, you know, it's a different universe. Supergirl, she's been through some stuff. I can understand why she's acting the way she's acting.
Batman's been through some stuff.
If you want to have a being through some stuff competition, I think we side with a billionaire. Oh, hang on. Maybe we don't.
No, because, you know, Supergirl, she hasn't sort of had the upbringing that, you know, a Clark Kent Superman would have had to instill the values in her that would prevent her from doing some of the decisions that she does. And so on that degree, I get it. You know, she's just been freed after a lot of time in captivity.
She's efficient. She's practical.
She's
she gets to the point. Team Supergirl.
Do you want to talk about the consultant? Do you want to talk about the brouhaha over the Secret Invasion opening credits?
Oh, yeah, we probably should.
I think we should talk about that. Let's talk about that. So there was a contretemps and a brouhaha over the opening credits of Secret Invasion, the new Disney Plus new Disney Plus show. We talked about this a little bit.
We
decried it.
I found out about it live on our
you
Spoiler
did.
Special podcast.
You did. We talked about it on our Spoiler Special, which you can subscribe to, of course, $2.99 a month, $32.99 a year, and you get all the Spoiler Specials. It's all really, really great. Anyway, plug over. And we talked about it on that, but let's talk about it here. So the opening credits of the new Disney Plus show, Secret Invasion, were generated by AI with admittedly some human interaction as well. Prompts.
I'd love to see the prompts. Dear ChatGPT, make us a title sequence for this.
That looks like dog shit.
Make it better. No, please, make it better. Yeah, I'd be interested to have read the transcript of that that exchange.
Yes, so director Ali Salim confirmed to Polygon, it said here, that the opening credits were generated by artificial intelligence designed by Method Studios. He says that he thought the idea of using AI for the opening credits fit into the theme of the show, which is all about Skrulls and shape-shifting and what's real and what's not, what's human and what's not. Yeah, I get that to an extent, but... pay an artist, for the love of God.
This
please.
Feels so horribly misjudged.
Yes.
Like, it just feels so... I mean, if they'd done it and just not told anyone on the sly, I mean, that would be bad too. But the fact that they've come out and said, oh, it's a virtue, we've done it like... I mean, how did they not see this coming, that everyone has reacted so negatively to it?
It has been... They've been absolutely hauled over the coals.
It's been a bloodbath, and rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially with everything that's going on at the moment, and I know it's not specifically about music, but with the writers on strike, with the actors going on strike, with the directors possibly striking, and AI being the heart of a lot of that, it's like, read the fucking room. I mean, Jesus.
I mean, I tweeted this, but Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is just a walking example of, these are artists who are passionate about their craft. Look at the beautiful work that they can create. More so than any other film I've really ever watched, especially animated, I've really enjoyed seeing people who worked on the film post-worked on the film. I've seen that on Twitter for like the last like 2-3 weeks. People keep retweeting, keep resharing. I know many of the artists' names now who have worked on this film, and it's great to, that they've been giving this platform to sort of showcase their work. Why are we... compare that to what's going on with this. It's like, stop trying to save money with this AI thing and just pay an artist to give us some beautiful
art. To be fair, none of those artists have given us the Pope in a puffer coat. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
So, yeah, no, I didn't like it at all. And as you say, it does not look very good.
No, it doesn't look good. It does not look good. I wonder if episode 3 will be accompanied by a completely different title sequence as they walk the entire thing back. It genuinely wouldn't shock me.
I would not be shocked at all.
Yeah.
The idea was always that the title sequence would become more human as time went on.
Yeah. Yes, I think
it's very disappointing, I have to say. I'm very disappointed in you, Marvel. Very disappointed in you. And those words will sting them. To hear that from me, the chief drinker of ooze, they're gonna hate that. They're gonna especially hate when I say that I'm pretty sure the first episode was written by AI as well. Oh dear, would it hurt you to have some drama and intrigue in your intriguing drama show? Anyway, shall we have a guest? Shall we have a guest?
Why not?
Enough of the movie news. Let's have a guest. Let us go straight into... Well, we've only got one, three guests, one slot, as we discussed earlier on. Asteroid City is Wes Anderson's new film. He's done it again, folks. And it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival last month. And we sent John Nugent to Cannes, and he talked to a whole bunch of people. And three of the people that he talked to were Jeffrey Wright, Bryan Cranston, and Adrian Brody, who star in this movie. Jeffrey Wright is an army man. Adrian Brody is a theater director man. And Bryan Cranston is a narrator man. So here they are in Cannes talking to John Nugent. Do please enjoy.
Thrilled to welcome to the Empire Podcast Adrian Brody, Bryan Cranston, and Jeffrey Wright. How are you all?
Good. Very good, thanks.
Excellent.
Good
to be with
nice
you.
To see you.
We are talking in Cannes. Have you guys just got here? Are you new to the festival?
I am new to the festival. Yeah. I've been to Cannes before, but not with a film.
Yeah.
My first time as well, had films here, but I've my first time being here to present with, and I just got here yesterday morning. So I'm here in body, but not entirely.
Biologically.
Yeah.
Just not that's a little previous.
That's a previous
interlude.
Inner thing.
Okay. And what about you, Adrian?
I love Cannes, and I've had several very meaningful experiences here, and I've been here with films and without, and I love the festival, and I think it's very special. It's very special to be here.
Yeah. What's your like festival approach? Because it can be quite an intense experience, right? Do you get a chance to sort of soak it up and see some films?
It depends on the, for me, I mean, it depends on what's the curriculum, you know? If I have, I just came off of shooting a film, and I'm pretty shattered, and yeah. I'm here to support this film, and yeah. I'm really grateful to be here. But I don't have much time or space to do anything else.
Yeah.
And I assume we're all in the same boat on this
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
But it's exciting. I mean, I've come and visited the festival and gone to films and.
Have you been on a jury before?
I have not in Cannes.
No,
not yeah. in Cannes, but yeah, it'd be fun.
That's a fun experience.
Yeah, it'd be really fun. It's a lot of work.
It is.
You have to see.
Did for Tribeca,
documentaries, well. Yeah.
Which was like I think the second year of the festival. Super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you watch a lot of films for that, right?
Mm-hmm. It's quite a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Your comments might change a filmmaker's
right.
life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we take it very seriously.
It's a big deal. Yeah. Yeah. So there's going to be no like big beach parties for you guys this time then? Is it going to be fairly well behaved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think fairly, yeah.
Yeah. The beach parties happen after where most of the films yeah. screen while we're actually doing, yeah. you know, promoting this film. But, yeah. you know, the parties, you know, if we can survive into the night, perhaps there might be a party or two here and there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this film, of course, Asteroid City, Wes Anderson's new film, which is fantastic. I mean, I'm such a huge Wes fan, and you guys are brilliant in it. But this is like not your first time for all of you, right? You've all done at least a couple of Wes films at this point.
Jeffrey and I have done two. He's the old pro.
Yeah,
he's been
you're the veteran.
500 or 600 Wes Anderson movies.
He's the muse.
Yeah.
Is it always a fun experience to come back to be invited back?
Just being invited back is a huge thing.
Yeah.
It is very nice.
Yeah, it's
working my way up the ladder.
It's a welcome email.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're part of the troupe now? You're part of the sort of regular players.
I don't know if I can after two films if you're in that club, but maybe it'd be nice. I mean, we're actors. We all want to be loved. And so, you know, if you hug us, then we'll be very kind.
It also says, you know, you did okay on the last one.
Which is
nice to hear.
You didn't mess it up.
Come
on back.
Yeah.
But I think it's not just performance, though.
Yeah.
I think absolutely there. If an actor is irritable or not. Mm-hmm. In the spirit of
the
group,
you're not welcome back,
I don't think so. No. I think if someone complains about, you know, what time they have to get up or how much, then I think that might be the end of that.
Yeah,
you know, because what we do and what Wes sets up is such a it's a beautiful situation for actors and other artists. Art direction or whatever, or casting director, and they are all invited to this location, and every night we have a very familial dinner together on an extremely long rectangular table, and we all share stories of the day or of our lives, and we get to know each other. So it's not just the experience of acting on the set; it is also the experience around the experience.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because you hear stories about these famous Wes Anderson dinners.
Yeah.
And it's such a lovely idea.
It's wonderful.
I mean, what do you actually talk about? What comes out of those gatherings?
Oh, see, he wants the inside scoop. Yeah. one of the nice things is that we don't have to worry about saying something that may be misconstrued or something, because in that environment, it's only our team.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was saying one, you know, I heard that Tom Hanks said that he was nervous going into a couple's, and I go, oh my God, thanks.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad I heard that because I am too. And me too. You are. Yes. And you realize it doesn't matter how much you've worked over the years, it's that we're still human, and there are still you're still dealing with human emotions that come up, and you have to deal with them. But for Wes to create an atmosphere that allows that kind of sharing and conviviality, it makes the experience far greater and more rewarding.
Yeah,
we had some interesting post dinner.
evenings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, great set of musicians, you know, working on this film.
Right, yeah, you've got Jarvis Cocker.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. The somewhat infamous Jarvis.
Yeah,
Cocker, right? From there was a moment with Michael Jackson, right? Wasn't there?
Oh yes, yeah, the Brit Awards. Yeah. He like flashes his butt at him.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that until after.
Hear that?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he comes up with it was a big. Big row.
I think he may even got arrested for it.
I think
it was
some kind of trial or something, or hearing or something. But anyway, we'd gather, you know, after dinner and just, you know, there'd be some concerts, you know, and we'd all kind of, we all sit around singing. Rita Wilson can blow.
She can.
Who knew?
She's got albums. She's like a recording artist.
So,
that's amazing.
And it builds, you know, community and camaraderie and trust.
Yeah.
It's also super efficient, you know, because we're basically all living together. Hair and makeup is downstairs. The editor's working, you know, somewhere over there. And you never leave work, you know. So Wes, it serves two purposes, you know, because I tell you, he's very ambitious. So he doesn't have he doesn't want to waste a lot of time.
Yeah.
Filmmaking is one of the most inefficient, you know, means of storytelling. You know, you shoot it all day and you get, you know, maybe, I don't know, what, 10 minutes of film, five, maybe three. So he wants, you know, he wants to use all the time, you know, as well as he can. So it creates, you know, this union, but it also, you know, it keeps you engaged and keeps you focused.
Yeah. Who does the cooking for this big dinner? Does Wes just do a big casserole or something? You
know, I'm usually back there.
Yeah. Are you?
Yeah.
What's your speciality? What's your
everything? Spam. Everything.
You know, like a spam.
Spam.
Spam. Yeah. Spam was at the last part. Well, we were in Spain, so we had.
We're in Spain.
Come on, Spain. We had that.
We had spam and Spain.
Spammy Berico, which was really delicious. Good stuff.
No, we had some good ham over there, though.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's very well catered. It's a very catered circus. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds great. And then when it comes to being on screen, I mean, obviously, Wes is famous for being very meticulous. Does that extend to your work? Do you have to be rigorous in your approach?
That's absolutely what happens, You have. I think there's an expectation that we all show up extremely well-prepared and, you know, Wes uses animatics as well. So he has these moving storyboards that are very informative. They're a great guide. I believe some of them have been. I keep telling him to as well. Yeah. I think they're fantastic.
Yeah,
they're really fantastic.
They're wonderful.
They're
and he voices every character.
Works of art in and of themselves.
Features,
and they're not just, they're because they incorporate. Even though they're drawings, they have the shots and the lighting cues and the dolly moves, et cetera, that are so you understand so much going into it to be prepared for it, for delivering something that is pretty intricate, you know. And Jeffrey's task on this film was enormous. I mean, it is really no small feat to do what he did, and I keep singing his praises all day, and I mean it. It's just to be able to own that amount of material is very much like a moment in a play, but it is more difficult because you can carry on in a play. Right. If you veer slightly or have a momentary or go with an emotional pull that leads you down something else. In this specifically, you have such a responsibility to deliver something so tightly. That as soon as you feel that you're not on that track, you can lose your track, right? And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have to be so laser focused because there's no time for thought.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you. It took me a while to get there.
It can take someone.
We did it.
Doesn't matter.
I showed up, and Wes said, I got off the plane. I practically got off the plane. Mm-hmm. He said, "Yeah, we're going to do the speech tomorrow." I said, "Do what? can I have some dinner first?" And so we did it, and I kind of said, "Wes," I said, "Wes, this is going to be kind of a rehearsal." He goes, "No." So we did it. We kind of got it. And he said, no, it's good. I said, I think it was kind of, eh. He goes, no. Well, 3 days later, he says, "Jerry, I think we're going to do it again. We'll do it again." So we did it again a couple of days later. Yeah. And it worked. It worked. He says, it was the first take, but it was the first take of the second day that, it took me a little bit to get there.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
How do you prepare for...
You're a hero.
Yeah. You are. How do you prepare for roles like this, though? Beyond, the line reading, do you go into, Brian, I wonder if, you turn to old 50s broadcasts for your character, right?
Yeah, I don't want to be Brian Cranston. I want to find a character. And so I'm doing some research in those 50s American newscasters. And I kept gravitating toward one in particular, Ted Koppel. And I didn't intend to. I was exploring with a bunch of different ones. And he just kept coming back to me. So then at one point I just gave into it and leaned into that. Gave me little anchors, some ballast, some weight to it that was helpful and grounding. And then you get into you understand the musicality of the rhythms of his speech as he writes them.
Yeah.
He was talking about the animatic, which Wes Anderson calls his cartoon. And in this cartoon, he voices all the characters.
Oh, wow.
In the entire movie, every single character in the movie, he voices them. So every actor watches that and you get a sense, that's how he sees my character speaking.
Yeah.
That's the rhythm he wants. That's the speed he wants. There's the emphasis on certain words that he wants.
Yeah.
And you start to see, that actually is very helpful to get that sensibility going.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite expressions of his on set is, let's look at the cartoon.
Yeah,
As I think about it, as we talk about it, I don't think that he's able to achieve what he does ultimately on camera without having made the choices prior and having this reference for it. He's done it already, in two dimensions. Otherwise, it's so specific, so detailed.
There's no way to convey all of that in a conversation.
Exactly, exactly.
And also to the camera department and the grips, et cetera. That is so there. It's so alive, the visual aspects of his film, especially in these fast moving masters.
He does it in a digital way that Alfred Hitchcock did it in a analog way when he would do storyboards and have pictures and have the boards up there. Psycho or whatever, and he'd cross them out when he got that shot, this angle, that angle, this. And so he would do his entire movie on a storyboard.
Well, the results are there. It looks amazing, and you guys are great in it. So I hope to see you in another Wes Anderson film soon.
Thank you.
Guys, that's my time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, so that was Brian Cranston, Jeffrey Wright, and Adrian Brody. What a hat trick, folks. And let's get into the reviews part of the show, only 4 days into the record. let's start with Asteroid City. It is the biggest film out this week, but is it the best film, Amon Warman?
No.
Let's move on now to No Hard Feelings, in which Jennifer Lawrence returned. Okay. Back it up. You want more?
Okay. Take me down to the asteroid city. Yes. Stars Jason Schwartzman as photographer Augie Steenbeck. He and his children make a stop in Asteroid City to repair his car. And while they are there, they encounter some unusual characters. I should probably preface this by saying that I've never really been a Wes Anderson guy.
It's weird because you dress like you're in one of his films.
I'll take that as a compliment because
you should.
That is one of the few things in this film that I did like. The costuming is great. The color palettes are very vivid. You know, all those typical things you would expect from a Wes Anderson film in terms of visuals are very much there, present and accounted for. For me, the story was just very confounding and alienating. There's a love story between Jason Schwartzman's character and Scarlett Johansson's character, which is the beating heart of the film. And I did sort of get hints of that. And I did fall in love with that to a degree. But there's so much else going on in this film, I wasn't allowed to really fully settle into a storyline. There's a Russian nesting doll narrative at play here. There's a lot of layers. And the longer the film goes on, the more tricky it is to sort of follow which character is playing what at which time. And therefore, the story arcs of a Scarlett Johansson, of a Jason Schwartzman, you don't really get to fully appreciate that because there's just so many layers of artifice to sift through. So that was really the thing for me. And one of the reasons that I've never really been a Wes Anderson guy, his dialogue is very, very stilted. It's delivered very monotonously. I know for hardcore Wes Anderson fans, that is sort of something that they like about it. In talking to some of those Wes Anderson fans, it's been really interesting. Some of them have said that this feels like almost a parody of a Wes Anderson film. There's actually a lot of that going around right now if you look at what's happening on TikTok, which is very interesting and amusing to a degree. But yeah, I would say this is one for hardcore Wes Anderson fans only. And even then, some of them are saying what they're saying. And me not being a hardcore Wes Anderson guy or even a softcore Wes Anderson guy, this was a bit of a frustrating watch for me.
Hardcore Wes Anderson is an interesting concept. It has to be said. I go back and forth. I think I'm very, very glad that he's making films. And yes, the obvious joke is Wes Anderson's made his film again. And oh boy, is that true. Mm. But, you know, John Nugent even pointed out in his review of the film in Empire, you know, it's a very, very easy jibe. He is a unique filmmaker. He is a completely idiosyncratic filmmaker. There is nobody else like him, which is wild because he's been around now for 25 years, something like that, as a filmmaker. Wow. And there is still no one else who is, despite all your TikTokers, it can get close to replicating his eye or his feel for dialogue. I love his feel for dialogue. I love the way he has these incredible actors rattling off dialogue at, you know, His Girl Friday speeds. It's wonderful to watch. And the performances in this are great. The cast, Amon, I think we've somewhat buried a lead. You've mentioned, we obviously have our three guests, Bryan Cranston, Adrian Brody, Jeffrey Wright. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned Jason Schwartzman playing a dad some 24 years after Rushmore, which that may be the oldest as anything's ever made me feel, by the way. But Scarlett Johansson, obviously, as well. But you have not mentioned, deep breath, Steve Carell, Tom Hanks, Maya Hawke, Rupert Friend, Matt Dillon in a role where he shows up for like three scenes. It's wild. Margot Robbie. Who else? Jeff Goldblum. Ed Norton. Yeah. Liev Schreiber. It's just Hope Davis. It's an incredible embarrassment of riches.
It's an incredible cast. How many of them are actually saying something that's really, really interesting, though?
I would say all of them are saying something that's really, really interesting. But I had a very, very interesting relationship, he said, interestingly, with this movie, in that there were times I just felt that it was ultra Wes, it was ultra arch, it was ultra ironic, and it kept you at arm's length more than something like The French Dispatch, which I thought was a wonderful film, or The Grand Budapest Hotel, or his best film, The Royal Tenenbaums, did. He manages to somehow find emotion and human connection in amongst all this very, very meticulous art directed within an inch of its life, mise en scène, if you will. I'm not sure that I'm not sure that he found an emotional core of this movie. It's very, very clever. It's funny at times, But there were a lot of times when I just thought, I'm not sure I'm jiving with this at all.
I did want to see it a second time before doing this pod. Again, I'd spoken to a few people who've watched this and they said they got along with it much better on a second watch. So I'm intrigued to see what I might find going on with you. But just on first watch, again, arm's length is right. I felt alienated for much of the runtime of this, even though the cast is great. Lots of A-listers doing their thing. It was a struggle for me.
Yeah. But yeah, I did find myself warming to it as it went on. Mm. And there's a very, very bold swing plot-wise about halfway through. In fact, there's a very bold swing conceptually quite early on, which I don't want to spoil for people. We've hinted at it, but yeah.
I will say that it is intermittently funny as well.
I did
laugh a couple of times.
Stick that in your poster. Intermittently funny. A Mon Warman Empire podcast.
Yes, at last.
At last. Fame at
my
last.
My moment to shine.
We gave this one 4 stars. John Nugent, who is a big Wes head, a big Andersonian, he loved it and he has given us 4 stars. I'm not in the 4-star camp, but I'm probably in the 3-star camp. Amon, you sounds like you're in the 2. You've moved into the 2.
Let's
area.
Let's bring
of town.
Half stars back. 2.5.
Then we have to round up. So 3 stars. Amon loves this film. We gave 4 stars to this one. 4 stars for Asteroid City. Jimbo.
Hello, Christopher.
Hello. Welcome back to the podcast.
I stopped listening the second you mentioned Wes Anderson and I went away to my own personal Asteroid City.
Come on, really?
No, I have no patience for whimsy or symmetry, quite frankly, or pastels. So really, I was out from the beginning.
You're not a Rushmore fan?
No, actually. Tenenbaums is the only one of his films I genuinely like. I appreciate them, and they're genius, and I think he's got an incredible eye, as you say, but
He's got two incredible eyes,
symmetrically.
You should see his ears. His ears are fucking incredible.
But they leave me cold. They just leave me cold.
Yeah.
Sorry.
This is embarrassing because he's outside, and he's about to go, Wes, I loved you in Wall Street. Yeah. It's a shame. 4 stars then for Amon going, this film's shit. James goes, I hate Wes Anderson. 4 stars then for Asteroid City. Jimbo, you went to see a film this week.
I did.
How are you? Did you
it was very exciting.
Did you have to have someone talk you through the process?
Well, genuinely. So I saw the film we are speaking of as a punter.
Oh
yes, I went to a public screening with the plebs.
I also paid with the plebs to see Asteroid City.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, where the grass is green and the aliens are pretty.
Right.
Oh, won't you please take me home?
I'm on. When that song came out, you wouldn't have been even a glimmer in anyone's eyes. So do not sing that to me.
A hands glimmer,
indeed. Yes, I went to see No Hard Feelings, and I have no hard feelings about seeing No Hard Feelings, which is obviously a good thing.
So what's it about? What's happening?
Well, it's funny you should ask, Chris. So this is a film that I saw in the cinema, which is directed by Gene Stupnitsky.
Yes.
And I saw the trailer for this a while back and was slightly wrong-footed by it for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. One, because Jennifer Lawrence, who... It's always interested me that she's never really embraced comedy as a genre because she's fucking hilarious. Like, you see her on a chat show, you see her on any interview, she is properly funny. She falls down every 5 minutes. She does slapstick in unintentionally, but she's genuinely very funny. Like, she's clearly got comedy chops.
Very sharp.
And yet she's been a very dramatic actor. And so you think, oh, great, she's doing a comedy. Then I saw the trailer for No Hard Feelings, which I thought looked supernaturally terrible. Like, but genuinely, I was like, oh my God, is this the end of Jennifer Lawrence's career? Like, genuinely, wow. I thought it looks awful. It looks puerile. It looks regressive in that kind of late 90s, early noughties sort of bawdy sex comedy kind of way. I was waiting for Stifler's mum to kind of walk past in the background, like, you know, all that stuff. And I just thought, oh my God. So when I went to see this, to say I had some trepidation would be an understatement.
You were trying desperately to buy a ticket for something else.
Indeed.
One ticket for anything else, anything please.
Have you got a Wes Anderson film? Anything, really. but it's not what it appears to be, while also being exactly what it appears to be. So this
is... Like a scroll.
Like a scroll. It's much like a scroll. So Jennifer Lawrence plays Maddie. She's an Uber driver whose car has been towed. And if you know anything about Uber as a business model, that's kind of a problem. So she needs money. She needs to save her house. She's about to lose her home due to gentrification. Lots of rich holidaying people are buying up the properties in her neighborhood until she is, shall we say, propositioned by some parents with an indecent proposal. They would like to pay her in the time-honored fashion of a Buick Regal to deflower their slightly introverted, socially awkward son, Percy, played here by Andrew Feldman. And she, frankly...
Who is 19, we should say.
He is 19,
but
yes.
His mind, he's only 19, but his mind is older.
Indeed. Well, no, see, the opposite is true. He's 19, but it's actually his mind is very much younger. Like, he feels like a very immature 19-year-old in that he hasn't come out of his shell, he doesn't socialise, he doesn't speak to girls, he's super, super awkward. She agrees, because frankly she wants the car, and so you have this slightly awkward scenario where she is befriending this boy, pretending that she's meeting him organically in a kind of true romance type fashion, and while also trying to shag him. So it's an icky premise. It's a very icky premise, and I feel like in another pair of hands, this would have gone exactly the way you think it would go. But I think Stemnitsky and John Phillips, who co-writes a screenplay for this, put a lot more emotional maturity into this than you would have thought, certainly than you would give it credit for. Like, there's a real sense of Percy as a person, someone whose two helicopter parents have kind of meant that he hasn't fully developed. He's never really been given the opportunity to go out and be his own person. He's terrified of absolutely everything. Meanwhile, Maddie is an interesting character that she's losing, as I say, losing her home to gentrification. She's still trying to find her niche in the world. She has sort of, shall we say, familial traumas of her own to deal with. And what this becomes, it's not a sex comedy. It's not even a about sex, it's about an unlikely friendship that develops between these two characters. And it's surprisingly touching and surprisingly genuine, while also being really funny. And yes, there are, I would say, first base comedy scenarios. There's a frat party at one point. I love the fact that, bearing in mind that Jennifer Lawrence is 32, and they're playing the kind of the massive generational divide between millennials and Gen Zers, which, as someone who is older than both of those, just makes people very, very, very odd. Combined. Makes me feel very, very old indeed. But that bit's properly funny. There is a genius sequence on a beach where she fights a bunch of people while absolute buck-ass naked. It's really funny. And I thought, actually, surprisingly charming. And at the end of it, I was like, wow, this kind of got me in the feels. Their friendship felt tangible. It felt real. While also being funny. And I'm not going to say profound. Let's not fucking push the boat out too far. But it works. It has an emotional maturity and emotional honesty that registered with me. So while this looks, as I said, supernaturally bad, it is neither of those
it's
things.
It's supernatural.
It is neither
good.
Supernatural, nor is it bad. We gave this 3 stars. Sophie Butcher wrote an excellent review of this, which you can read now on the Empire website. But do you know what? Go and see this. And if you, like me, have to do the unthinkable and pay to go to the cinema to do it, it won't kill you to do so.
Yes.
You will have no hard feelings about this.
Just don't go buck-ass naked.
I mean, you can, but it's frowned upon.
You can.
I found that out to my cost.
Amon, did you have hard feelings?
I did not have hard feelings about this film. I second pretty much everything James just said. I had a really good time with it. I thought Jennifer Lawrence was fantastic. I don't think, actually, as I say that is quite as funny as you make it out to be, James, in part because, as Sophie points out in her very good review, a lot of the gags were in the trailers for this
film. But that's not really that's not sort of a criticism of the film, is it? That's just a criticism of their marketing campaign,
yeah,
but they've taken loads of the gags and front-loaded them.
Yeah, it meant that I didn't sort of like full-on, you know, belly laugh during this. I had good chuckles, but it wasn't like a full-on belly laugh at any point. But the emotional maturity, as you mentioned, was really, really great. I actually think this film is a lot better when it's not trying to go joke heavy. Jennifer Lawrence, it's really cool to see her in this type of role. I hope she takes on more comedies because she definitely has the right spirit for it. And I thought she was great in this film.
It's interesting because I was at the same screen you were at, Amon, and it was interesting because it was one of those experiences. I was laughing fairly consistently all the way through, and I felt so judged. I felt I could just feel people glaring at me, going, "Oh yeah, there he is, Mr. Lowest Common Denominator, Mr. Chief Drink the Marvel Ooze. Oh, you like the silly sex comedy, do you, stupidissimo?" But you know, what the hell? You could just feel the moral panic in the room, to be quite frank. But the movie knows that it's towing the it's towing the edge of a very, very risky line. It's basically a reverse risky business, except without a real element of danger. It doesn't have a Guido the Killer Pimp or anything like that.
That self-awareness is important, though.
It is important because it knows that it's getting into these areas and it can actually navigate them fairly, fairly well, I would say.
Yeah, 100%. Like, you mentioned the age gap, which
yes.
could be icky, but they refer to that and actually have storytelling to that at multiple times in the film.
My disappointment with it, despite laughing all the way through, Gene Stupnitsky is, along with Lee Eisenberg, who didn't co-write this, but they co-wrote some of the best episodes of the American version of The Office. And they're very, very funny dudes. And Gene Stupnitsky is a very, very funny dude. And there were times I was watching this going, this is a funny scene, but it could be funnier if it just pushed it a little bit more. I'm not saying push the raunch or push the awkwardness of the situation, but maybe just a couple of extra drafts, maybe just, you know, punch up the jokes a little bit more and you could have really had an all-timer of a sequence. Mm. But it is, you know, that beach scene, honestly.
Oh my gosh. I did not expect that.
No, I don't think anyone's expecting that. But it's a fairly bold scene, but I wondered if the rest of the film had been like that and had that sort of boldness, then maybe it might have been an all-timer of a kind of a teen sex comedy type thing. But as it is, 3 stars, that ain't no bad shakes at all. So 3 stars then for No Hard Feelings. Are there any hard feelings, James, for Nimona, which
None
is on Netflix?
None whatsoever. Nimona, which lands on Netflix. Now, this is based on N.D. Stevenson's graphic novel. And this is a film that, frankly, you are very fucking lucky to be able to watch. So this was a Blue Sky animation, which was acquired by Disney when they picked up Fox. And mothballed. Absolutely. So this very nearly didn't come to fruition at all until Annapurna stepped in and you know, essentially finished the film. And I'm really pleased they did because I absolutely loved Nimona. My Nimona. I'm not going to start singing it to you, Amon. Sorry. but it's really, really lovely. So this is about a knight called Ballister, played by Riz Ahmed. He's voiced by Riz Ahmed. And he's about to be accepted into this kind of like fighting force, this sort of group of knights who defend the kingdom when he is, shall we say, something goes awry, someone dies, he's cast out and is forced to go on the run. Now, he then meets up with the titular Nimona, who's voiced by Chloe Grace Moretz. And she is a shapeshifter. She's kind of an outcast. She's like a villain, a would-be villain. And she's decided he's going to be a great villain and she's going to be his sidekick, whether he wants it or not. She's a bit punk, she's a bit rebel, she says metal or not and makes a sign of the devil, and she's an incredible amount of fun to be with. And that's part of why this film is so good, because you absolutely buy the friendship between Ballister and Nimona. She's a fantastic foil to everything he does. And this is, it's like a subversive take. You can kind of understand weirdly why Disney didn't want to make it, but it's a very subversive look at classic Disney fairy tales. So the world is, it's a high fantasy world, but in the future. So there are cars, there's technology. So it starts in a high fantasy setting and then it flashes forward. I think it's like 1,000 years ago until they have this high-tech society. And it's looking at inclusion. It's looking at how people are judged. It's looking at people being comfortable in their own skin. And it's looking at how hate is taught and that it isn't innate to people. It's really interesting, but it doesn't... So there's a lot of social commentary in here, but it's not one note. So, you know, you could see it as a parable for coming out and being your authentic self. You could see it as a parable for accepting people for who they are. You could see it as a parable for, you know, the othering of different groups for whatever reason. And all this stuff is in there and none of it is rammed down your throat and it feels really authentic and organic to the story. In addition, like the main character, Ballister, is gay, but it's not really a plot point. It's just there. But more than anything else, it's funny, it's fun, it's visually inventive, it's this kind of 2D, 3D style of animation. Lots of great ideas in there. The gags really land. Nimona's at the heart of most of them. There is a dancing shark, and frankly, all films can be improved by the presence of a dancing shark. But I loved this film. I genuinely loved it. I thought it was heartwarming. I thought it was affecting. It brought a tear to my eye in places. Yeah, it's an absolute joy. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, kids will love it. I think adults will love it. It's got a little bit of something for everyone. So I'm very, very pleased that Annapurna stepped in and saved this from, frankly, dying.
Yes.
Because it's a film everyone should see if they get the chance.
Yeah, it's really good.
Just James Dyer liking animated films.
I know, yeah, what happened?
Isn't it? It's a smile on
it's
my face.
It's wild. And you know what? Again, this is the second film this week. I went into this going, oh, fuck me. I've got to watch this now as well. I didn't really want to watch it at all. And I was... to say pleasantly surprised would be an understatement. I had to stop watching it to come in for my commute so before I could watch the rest. And I was frankly nearly late for the train because I was like, I don't want to turn it off.
Walking into lampposts.
Yeah. I was like, this is great. I'm loving it. Absolutely loving it.
Yeah, it's really good.
So, yeah. My Nimona.
Mm-hmm. I echo that. Watch Nimona. It's on Netflix. 4 stars. 4 stars then for Nimona. And I think that's it. I think that's it. Tight 80.
Yes. That was a tight record. No flab on that podcast at all.
What the fuck am I doing?
All lean.
Honestly, I've got to edit this tonight. Oh. One more thing to talk about before we wrap this bad boy up is that we are doing a live show. We are going back into the live arena. We are,
woohoo!
Well, yes, indeed. September 9th, we are going to be at King's Place London, our spiritual home, as part of the London Podcast Festival. I think it's 7:30, something like that, on Saturday, the 9th of September.
Yes.
Tickets are on sale right now. And I think, as usual, if we sell enough tickets or we sell out, which would be very, very lovely, then we will open up streaming as a possibility. As ever with our London Podcast Festival podcasts, this is a one-off bespoke podcast. It will not be available as a podcast afterwards. So if you want to watch it, you either got to be there or
be stream square.
It, or be square.
But if you don't, it will be on Disney Plus within 4 weeks.
It will be, yeah. Yes, with an AI opening sequence
as
well.
That's right. Will there be cake at the live show, Chris?
No, James.
Because you know where there will be cake, don't you? At the Pilot 250th podcast, which is taking place in August, we are having a Pilot TV bake-off. This is absolutely true. I might need your help.
When is it?
It's on the 19th of August. The 19th of August. So you should absolutely buy tickets for both of those things.
You are not
busy. You will be there. We have a professional baker judging the cakes. I'm not even joking. We are actually doing this bake-off thing.
Do you have a candlestick maker and a butcher as well?
And a baker, yes. All of those things.
Let me see.
I love that we're live coordinating your diary.
No, I am back.
Yes.
I am back.
You'll be there.
I didn't say that. But I will be back.
You'll be there. I'll save your seat in the front row.
Yeah. All right. So that's exciting.
You will taste test all of the baked goods.
I will. But I cannot stress this enough. If you come and see a live show, buy tickets for the Empire podcast live show first.
Without cake.
But with the AI opening sequence, and one of us will be AI on the day as well.
It'll be me. Frankie
will be phoning it in. And then buy tickets for Pilot 250.
Yeah.
People said they wouldn't reach 250.
They were wrong.
They were very lamentably wrong. Yeah. But there we are.
They're still getting over it.
And then after you spent all your money on those two shows, buy tickets to see Taylor Swift play Anfield, Liverpool Football Club's beloved stadium, Anfield.
This is how you're getting me to Anfield, isn't it?
This is how I'm getting you to Anfield.
Would you be surprised to hear that I have literally registered for the Liverpool Taylor Swift gig?
Dude, that's...
this is actually a thing that I have done.
Is she playing Wembley as well?
I have registered for Wembley, Liverpool and Edinburgh.
Wow.
I'm going to go to one of them. I will be there.
By hook or by crook.
Absolutely going to happen.
51 yards away from her at all times.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure this podcast was supposed to end at least 4 hours ago. So...
Can we end this podcast? Can we really end this podcast?
No, it's life. When they give you life, that's exactly what they take.
Should we end this podcast, though? Because here's my dilemma. If I end this podcast, at some point I'm going to have to start editing this podcast.
Whereas if we just keep recording...
Never have to edit it.
Just keep going. Yeah. Keep on going.
Macquarie
like
will
Thelma
come in
and
at some
Louise,
point.
We'll keep on going.
We'll just turn this into a Mission Spoiler special at some point.
Let's do it. We'll play for time.
I accept.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So let's just bring this podcast to an end, shall we? Put everyone out of their misery. Tight 80. Why do I do this to myself?
It's hard to say.
This is self-hatred. This is being played out in front of you on a grand scale. Join us next week for more Film Related Fun, I guess. When we'll be joined by... what's out next week? I'm on What's Out.
Is Indie next week?
Indie's next week.
Is Indie next week?
Yes.
Yeah. We have our Empire VIP Club event next week, which is very, very exciting. And we will have some special guests from that film. popping along to a London venue. Hopefully we'll be at the same place. And hopefully they're not digging in the wrong place. That would be embarrassing. And they'll be on next week's podcast. Those people whose names I cannot reveal. Not John Williams, sadly. Not the goat. They won't quarantine. They wouldn't let him in. Sorry, mate. Can't bring a goat over here. This is Oscar-winning composer. You fucking idiots.
The most nominated person in Oscar history. John Williams.
End the podcast immediately before one of us dies.
What are you doing this weekend?
Oh my God.
I'll be at the London Action Festival.
So will I. Yeah, so will I. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Might see you there.
Maybe.
When's Taylor going on sale, James?
They haven't said. You register for tickets now and then they will be available at some point. I don't know quite how it works. One does not normally go to the live music gigs.
One does not simply walk into Anfield. We'll also be joined by someone else. I think maybe the stars of Elemental. I don't know. Who's keeping track? Not me, that's for sure.
I'm going to murder you. I'm actually going to murder you.
Until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. James Dyer.
I mean, I want to just leave at this point, but I can't leave without saying, do you know what?
You can't leave.
You can never leave.
Where's the thing about it?
No,
right?
Ben, shush. I was going to tell you what guest is going to be on the Pilot TV podcast this week, but I don't know. Will it be Anson Mount, who I spoke to this morning for Star Trek Strange New Worlds? Will it be Wendell Pierce that Amon is speaking to tomorrow for Jack Ryan? It could be either, both, or none of those, because frankly, I'm quite disorganized. But there will be someone on the Pilot TV podcast. And a lot of people, I should say this, a lot of people in the reviews for the Pilot TV podcast have said, I really like this podcast. I only listen to it because James wouldn't shut the fuck up about it on the Empire podcast. So whatever I'm doing seems to be working. So if I'm going to push any of the rest of you over the edge, please, please take the plunge.
Can I ask if you mention the Empire podcast on Pilot?
I do, regularly.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, I know that, obviously, because I listen to it religiously. I'm a consumer of all kinds of media.
Yes, you're a big Pilot fan.
In that way, I find myself very much like a Tom Wamsgams. Don't you feel? I'm plugged in.
Yes,
I'm plugged into all kinds of different media.
Yeah, I'm going to shiv you if you don't end this fucking podcast.
Well, on that note, that is it. It's goodbye from Amon Worman.
That was interesting. Peace.
It's like an Amon Worman soundboard in here. It's quite incredible.
Does anyone else think it's ironic? Ironic.
Martin Scorsese's ironic.
That Amon Warman says peace when he leaves.
I do think it's ironic.
You should be Amon Peace Man.
It's like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife.
I'll give you a. That's not a knife.
Let's make peace, not war, man. Yeah.
Anyways, goodbye from me as well. I'm off to try and gazump James for Taylor Swift tickets. I can't wait to see his face when I see Tay-Tay at Anfield.
I knew you were trouble when you walked in.
I don't get it.
I understood that effort.
I'm seeing red.
I really didn't.
Oh, well, listen. Thanks for listening. See you next week. And any immortal words of Logan Roy. Fuck off!